Well, in the first session, we looked at four motivations for the study of God, and we saw in that it's all expansive. The knowledge of God is ultimate. Knowledge of God is life itself. We were created to know our Creator, and so we will find our greatest joy in fulfilling that calling in our lives. We saw the third motivation was that worship, that for which any believer is going to strive. Worship is dependent upon the knowledge of God, and our worship is only as good as that knowledge of God is. And then fourthly, we looked at the knowledge of God as being the great engine for godliness, that we are best motivated toward that kind of life of godliness by the knowledge of God itself. So we looked at those four motivations and set the tone with that, and then we looked at the two beginning perfections that help us on the right trajectory, and that, first of all, we must recognize when we speak of the knowledge of God, we're never talking about a full comprehension. To comprehend means to get our minds around. To comprehend means to fit God within our minds. And if we could fit God within our minds, that would be a very puny deity. In fact, all false religions are really the essence of that, created by man's ingenuity, his intuition, and they are no gods at all. And that's why so often, especially in the Old Testament, God will say, compare me with them. Who is like me? And what marks God as different than all other gods is that he is incomprehensible. He is not the product of our imaginations, and he can't fit within our minds. And we also talked about the knowability of God. Yes, God's incomprehensibility means that only God defines God, and only God knows who God is in the full sense, pure, total, complete, perfect sense, and that we cannot, but God has not remained in the darkness. He has revealed himself. He is knowable. He has the disposition to make himself known and the ability to do so. Now what we want to do in this next session, remembering especially those two introductory perfections, is to look more at a survey of God's perfections. Obviously, in a day like this, there's no way that we can get through all of the different perfections that God has revealed to us, all the different things that reveal to us his deity. So we're going to treat a lot of this in a survey fashion. And what we want to do in this particular session is look at some ways in which to categorize or to understand the big picture of God's perfections. And I want to begin with a quote that reminds us of why this is so important, and again, helps us to recognize the priority, the ultimacy that this topic has in life. Mark Jones, in a wonderful book, and I would highly recommend it, it's a book with the title God Is, and it's really a devotional book where he takes many, many different perfections of God that are revealed to us in Scripture, and he puts them into a very accessible description and a devotional format. So if you're looking for a resource that will guide you through that even in an introductory way, if this is a little bit of a fearful topic, I would say this is a great place to start with Mark Jones's book, God Is. But he says this near the beginning of his work. He says, "The doctrine of God has fallen on hard times. Many are far more concerned about personal salvation than they are about God. Books on marriage abound, but books on the doctrine of God are few and far between. This is regrettable, since nothing can ever really make sense to us in this life unless we have a good grasp of who God is." End quote. I think you could see this if you would, just in any general Christian context, if you would offer different seminars to a group of people, one seminar being, how to have the best marriage, another seminar on how to save for the future, another seminar on maybe even fighting the sin of lust, and then a fourth seminar on the perfections of God. Not in a church like this, but in many other places, you would find that probably the first three seminars would be filled with people, and the final seminar on the character of God would be sparse. And that's because, as we've already said, the tendency is to become so focused in the problem itself and in finding a solution. Now, I don't want to trivialize the problem. We do have to deal with the problem. We do have to work through a practical set of steps to mortify sin and to put on virtue, to put on righteousness. And that takes time. It takes deliberation. It takes intentionality. But the solution itself is not the biggest issue. The giver of that solution is. And if we are to enjoy the solution, it'll only come with a proper appreciation for and a hunger for the one who gives it. And that is God himself. And so it's important for us to talk through these issues. And sometimes the issues about God can become very technical or sometimes abstract because we're trying to wrestle with things that are so different than us. It's easier to talk about marriage in many regards, as painful as that can be with revealing all of our selfish habits within marriage and what creates problems in marriage. It still is easier to talk about those things because there's so much related to us. And when we talk about God, we recognize it's wholly other, and it's just so far beyond us, and so it's a more difficult conversation. But we must realize that's where the solution is ultimately going to come from, and we have solutions because God is who God is. That's why we can find solutions to broken marriages and solutions to the problem of lust, mortifying it and putting on righteousness. We have solutions because of who God is. Now, what we want to do in this session is look at some of these issues kind of from the satellite perspective, bigger picture issues, before the third session where we're going to talk about more specifically of God's perfections and define a few of them and talk how those perfections relate specifically to counseling situations. This one is a little bit of a technical session, but I think we'll see why these things are going to be helpful. Let me begin with the definition of an attribute. What is an attribute of God? We will use that language. And in fact, a lot of the books that you do find on the character of God will talk about the attributes of God. The famous one, of course, being the one by Stephen Charnock, the Puritan writer who entitled his work, The Existence and Attributes of God. And if you would just look on, you know, do a Google search or what have you, you'd come up with a lot of different books entitled The Attributes of God. What is an attribute? Well, one theologian has defined it this way. The divine attributes are the essential properties by which God makes himself known to us who are weak, and those by which he is distinguished from creatures. The divine attributes are the essential properties by which he makes himself known to us who are weak, and those by which he is distinguished from creatures. So we talk about the attributes of God. We're talking about the way in which God has described himself to us. And it's important to define attribute that way, because attribute can actually be defined the exact opposite, to attribute. And so sometimes theologians will say this term could have a weakness to it, because it can communicate to someone not familiar with the language that we're attributing to God certain things. And so we attribute to God immortality. We attribute to God infinity. We attribute to God omniscience and omnipotence and holiness and righteousness. We attribute to God aseity. That's not what we mean when we talk about an attribute of God. Instead, we look at it more as a characteristic. It's the way, it's a property by which God makes himself known to us. And that property is also something which distinguishes him from us as creatures. There's another term that is used, and that's the term that I'm typically using in our session, although I think you can use these terms generally interchangeably, but it's a term that I prefer a little bit more. It's the term perfection. What is a perfection? And Joel Beakey and Paul Smalley define it this way: God's attributes are also called his perfections, to highlight that he has every good and admirable quality to the highest degree. So we talk about the ways that God has made himself known to us as his perfections, whether that's his omniscience, omnipotence, omnipresence, that he is spirit, that he is infinite, that he is eternal, he's truthful, he's faithful, all these different things, these properties, we'll call his perfections. And they're perfections because they exist in him to the highest degree. These things that make God God are perfections because he is perfect. He is the perfect being, and he's perfect in a way that's going to be different than what we are anticipating when we enter glory. We talk about the fact that we will be perfect in that setting too, but the perfection that we are all longing for in glory, the perfection we hunger for, that moment when we enter that next stage of our existence, we will receive our glorified bodies, we will be perfect. It's perfection in a creaturely definition. It's perfection in a limited way. We will not receive omniscience, omnipotence, omnipresence. We will be perfect in a limited way that is perfect for the status of creatures. But when we talk about God and his perfections, it is perfection of a totally different class, of a totally different sphere. It is perfection to the in infinite degree. And we talk about these things as perfections of God because they are properties of God that he has revealed to us that are glorious and majestic and beautiful. And so we call these things such as aseity and omnipresence and love and justice and righteousness as his perfections, because to be God, he possesses these to the perfect degree. Attribute and perfection. Now, as we think of these things and survey these perfections in God, I want to ask and answer three crucial questions related to the perfections of God. And again, this is introductory. If we were to study all of God's perfections as revealed in Scripture, we would be here days upon days, and that would be a wonderful thing. But we have other requirements and responsibilities as well. But here in this session, I want to ask some questions that relate to these perfections in a more summary fashion. And the first question I want to ask and answer is this: how are God's perfections categorized? If we talk about these properties by which God has made himself knowable to us as being omnipresent, as being self-sufficient, as being all-wise, as being holy, how do we categorize these things? Because we as creatures benefit in our learning from categories and distinctions and things like that. So theologians have wrestled with this, knowing that categories can be helpful. And so when it comes to God's perfections, there's an attempt to categorize these into different sections or different types of perfections. And I want to survey this, and I think you'll understand why this is helpful even in counseling when we get to the end of this particular session. Now, one of the ways in which theologians will categorize God's perfections is to treat them in two different ways. Take some of God's perfections and say they relate to who God is in his transcendence, and other perfections relate to who God is in his immanence. Transcendence relates to God's holy otherness, that which utterly distinguishes him from anything in creation. That's his transcendence. He is high and lifted up, distinct from us, holy other. And theologians have said there are certain qualities or properties which belong to that emphasis. And yet God is near. He's close. Immanence means nearness. Immanence, spelled with an A, means nearness. But God is also near to his creation. And so what are the properties of God that relate to that nearness? And so theologians have wrestled with putting God's perfections into those two categories. And one text that actually is somewhat helpful here in showing this distinction is Isaiah 57, verse 15, where we see in the first part of verse 15 God's transcendence. For thus says the high and exalted one who lives forever, whose name is holy, I dwell on a high and holy place. Now, if you look at that, you'll notice some of God's properties that are connected with his holy otherness. He's high. He is exalted. He's eternal. He lives forever. He's holy. His name is holy. We'll define that after lunch. He says, I dwell in a high and holy place. So there you have his transcendence, and you could put a lot of properties within that particular category, and that might be helpful for us to think in that way. And then in the second half of verse 15, you have God's immanence emphasized. And also, he dwells with the contrite and lowly of spirit in order to revive the spirit of the lowly and to revive the heart of the contrite. And there you have the emphasis God makes on his grace, his mercy, his compassion come through in that second half. And so theologians have said, well, here's a good paradigm. Let's consider God and who God is, even though he is incomprehensible. What he has made known to us, we can divide into these two categories. And that's somewhat helpful. Another way that theologians have sought to categorize the properties God has revealed to us is to separate them, and you're going to see kind of along the same lines, but with different terminology. We're going to see that you can define certain properties according to God's greatness and certain properties according to his goodness. And theologians will say this when they're talking about the perfections of God. They'll say some perfections, some properties deal specifically with God's essence. In some way, and I don't like the term, but his constitution. It's not a good term, but his essence. For example, attributes or perfections like his self-existence, his aseity, his infinity, his triunity, his Trinitarian essence, that these are part of his essence. And so we could say that refers to God's greatness. And we can put those properties in this column of properties of greatness. And then in the other column, properties of God's goodness relate to God's morality, his interaction with those outside of himself. So things like truthfulness and love and holiness, that his relationship to that which is outside of his essence. And that is a reference to his goodness. So some have sought to do that. Another way that theologians have tried to categorize God's properties that he's revealed to us is You might come across some of this and some of the more technical writing is to make a distinction between God's absolute perfections and his relative perfections. And this, again, follows somewhat of the same kind of distinction that we've just talked about between his greatness and his goodness. Absolute perfections refer to who God is in himself, and relative perfections relate to God's relationship to his creation, relative. So absolute, that which God is in himself, what he was in eternity past when there was no creation, is absolute perfections. And then God's relative perfections, that when he brings creation into existence, he relates to it, if you could use that kind of terminology. We have to be careful, but he relates to it in certain ways, and that relationship is expressed in certain properties. A fourth way is even more technical and sometimes a little more difficult to understand, is negative and is positive perfections. Now, negative here doesn't mean something bad, but negative instead refers to those properties that God has in himself in which he is distinct from or opposite from creatures. Now, anything that's a creature is limited. A creature is limited in time and limited in space, limited in knowledge. Creatures have limitations. There's no way of getting around that. And I'll even say this, even when we do experience the glory of Revelation 21 and 22 and the eternal heavens and the eternal earth, even in that blessed environment, that glorious paradise, we still will have limitations because we're creatures. And so theologians have said, well, negative properties or negative perfections are the perfections that are the exact opposite of what creatures are. So, for example, creatures are mutable. Creatures change. God is immutable. He never changes. Creatures are finite. Even in their perfection, creatures are finite. We have bodies. That's important to realize. A body is different than spirit, God's spirit, in that God is what we say is infinite. But anything that has a body is obviously not, because it's contained within limits. We are comprehensible, but God is incomprehensible. And you can go down the line, and often you'll find it in those perfections that appear as negating something, immutable, incomprehensible, infinite, and so on. Those are what are sometimes called God's negative properties, because they set him as exactly opposite of creatures. Positive attributes or positive perfections, properties, on the other hand, describe that which God does share, can share with his creation, particularly with his image bearers, such as faithfulness, love, goodness, those kinds of things that can be reflected, even in a derivative sense, in creation. And those are sometimes called God's positive perfections. Another way in which God's perfections are distinguished is one of the more common ways, and this is a way that probably you have most frequently heard, and that's to distinguish them between communicable and incommunicable perfections. And an easy way to describe this is we're all familiar with communicable diseases. Right? What's a communicable disease? It's a disease that we could pass on one to another. An incommunicable disease is a disease that we can't. It's a genetic thing or something like that that cannot be passed on to another person. That same idea is used to describe the perfections of God. There are communicable and incommunicable perfections. Communicable perfections are those which God can share with his image bearers. Things like truthfulness, love, justice, righteousness. Those are things that can be, whether it's through God's original design or whether it's through God's redemptive design, that there's certain properties that God has that can be reflected in us. In fact, you know, we're called the image bearers of God. We were created that way initially in the garden. That was corrupted by the fall, but then we are a recreation in a special way, recreated in order to be able to reflect the glories of God. And these would be the communicable attributes. And we become like God as we are transformed, and more we reflect these things in our own lives. These certain properties, faithfulness and truthfulness, compassion, and so on and so forth. But then there are incommunicable attributes that we will never share, such as omnipresence. God doesn't redeem us so that we can start becoming omnipresent or omniscient. God does not redeem us so that we can know all things. We never will, as he knows. Omnipotent, he doesn't recreate us in order to share in that. So there are perfections that God does share with his creation and those which he does not. But now with all of these, the struggle that we face and that theologians wrestle with is that while these categories can be helpful, and we certainly wouldn't say that these things are harmful to categorize, but no categorization ever is sufficient. You've probably even noticed it. As I've gone through these different ways of categorizing, you've probably said, well, what about, and if you had those what about questions, you're right. There just is no satisfactory way in which we can survey what God has revealed to us, the things revealed, and put them in these nice categories. There's always exceptions, and the reason for that is that God isn't meant to be divided into categories. That all of who God is, he's not divisible. He's not made up of components that can be neatly arranged. In fact, as we look at all of God's perfections, is that they are perfections because they exist with one another and cannot be taken away from each other. And that is what makes God God, is that he possesses all of these things and, of course, more that he hasn't revealed. And so neat little categories are just beyond our ability, and we shouldn't expect that, and we must always treat these things with a great deal of hesitancy as we seek to survey and know and understand God. There's just no easy way, and that's not what we're supposed to do in putting God into different categories. Now, the second question, as we go through this survey, the first question was, how do we categorize God's perfections? And we can come up with some general ideas, but also conclude that it's impossible to do so at any kind of definitive level. The next question, though, is then how are God's perfections related to each other specifically? God has these properties, or he has revealed himself in this way as having properties. So how do we relate these properties, his love, his infinity, his spirituality, his triunity, his aseity, his omnipresence, omnipotence, and sovereignty, and how do we relate those things to who God is? And theologians have struggled with this as well, and here we get into a little bit more of a serious issue with some very definite risks. Let me give you some incorrect ways to understand the relationship of God's perfections to each other. And one of the major incorrect ways that people perceive of God is that God's perfections are parts of God's existence. So he's made up of pieces. He's made up of these components. So he's made up of some love, he's made up of some righteousness, he's made up of some aseity, holiness, and so on and so forth. And people will think of these things as pieces to a puzzle, and when you've got them all in place, then you have all of God. And they think of God as a component being. And the flaw with this is that it makes God the sum of his parts. And it's important to recognize this is a fatal flaw, because what we have done in this kind of an idea is really take from what we know of ourselves and to think of God according to ourselves, because we, after all, are composite beings. You know, we are made up of body and spirit. We're made up of, you know, you can even look at the physical sense and can say we're made up of however many parts water and however many parts this, however many parts that. We can look at our spiritual sense and, you know, you have the heart, the mind, the soul, and possibly some distinction there even with the spiritual aspect. And we know that we have these parts. How do you define them is a little bit difficult, but we think of ourselves as parts. And then we say, well, God must be like that then too. And that is fatally wrong. God is not made up of parts. He is absolutely righteous and absolutely good. He's absolutely omnipotent and absolutely holy and absolutely just, absolutely loving. These are all qualities which mark God in his absolute sense. You can't say God is 20% love, 20% goodness, 20, you know, and those kinds of compartments don't exist within the character of God. He is one. He is indivisible. He is not made up of pieces. And you might say, well, how does that affect counseling? We'll get to that in a few moments. God is not made up of parts. He's not made up of pieces, which we call his perfection. Secondly, when we speak of God's perfection, sometimes, and this is more common, sometimes people will speak of perfections that are greater and some that are lesser. And this too is incorrect. And this is certainly common within our day. A lot of people will say, well, God is love. And then to a lesser degree, God is just or God is righteous. Or they will conceive of God as being made up of love, and then other attributes or perfections are kind of derivative of that, and lesser in influence or lesser in importance. And once again, the problem with this approach is that it suffers the same flaw as the previous one. It's because you're compartmentalizing God. You're saying God is two parts this and one part that, or that you have one part that is really dominant and other parts that play a lesser role, and that leads to a lot of wrong thinking of who God is. And we know this because in many circles, professing Christian circles, you will have professing Christians make the kind of statement, well, God is love, and yes, he has said these things about these sins. He said this about homosexuality, or he said this about divorce, or he said this and that. But God is love, and so his love will conquer his righteousness, or will conquer his wrath, or will conquer his justice. And that kind of language is antithetical to who God is. It is heresy. God's perfections are in no way at battle with each other. There is never any internal struggle with who God is. And some will say, well, what about the cross? Isn't the cross the triumph of God's love over his righteousness or over his wrath? No, it isn't. Not at all. In the cross, we see all of God's perfections displayed. His wrath as well as his love. His justice as well as his mercy. There's nothing that is suffocated or nothing that is silenced in God in the cross. Instead, it's put on display. God's perfections are not more dominant than others, such as love over righteousness or compassion over justice and so on. Instead, the way to conceive of God's perfections is that God's perfections, his properties, are his essence. It's who he is. And so if you were, and these diagrams, of course, are inadequate because I hate to put any kind of line around God, right? Because he's infinite, right? So he's not contained. So it's even that analogy that I have on here is inadequate. I want you to understand that. He's infinite. But in terms of understanding who God is, there's no separation in or among his properties or perfections. There's no perfection that is elevated over another. There's no internal battle. God is in no way schizophrenic, as some have sometimes described him as having thoughts contrary to himself, in himself, that certain perfections are battling each other within God, and he's wondering what to do and frustrated because he wants to be who he is, but he can't because of this, or he can't do what he wants to do. All kinds of patently errant thinking because people have not studied the scriptures and instead base it on intuition and often take their own experience and intuition and they attribute that to God. God does not merely possess these perfections. He is these perfections. There is a difference. Because when you say, I possess something, there is a little bit of a distinction between your essence and the thing possessed. Now, I get it. Christians will say God possesses holiness, God possesses love, and there's not necessarily any ill will or maliciousness intended in that, but God doesn't possess these things as if they are distinct from his essence. No, he is these things, and that's why you find in Scripture the assertions made that God is holy, God is love, and so on and so forth. So that question was, how do God's perfections then relate to each other? And the correct view is to see God not as compartmentalized, not as made up of pieces, but to see his perfections as existing in perfectness. And God is these things rather than just merely possessing these things. Now, how do these perfections then affect counseling? I want to bring it back to our setting here and the ministry that you're engaged in as you seek to encourage and admonish one another in the spirit of Ephesians 4, verse 12. Now, in humanistic counseling, by definition, humanistic counseling is man-centered. It begins and ends with man. Humanistic counseling, whether that's psychology and psychiatry and all the secular forms of therapy that are out there, the characteristic with all of them is that the standard, the beginning point, and the end point is always man. It's always the experience, the circumstances, the earthly context is always all that is, and whatever is transcendent is secondary at best. Even Christian counseling can be man-centered in that it dominantly is focused on man and dominantly focused on the problems and the needs of man. And the counselor approaches the situation in this kind of setting, even as a professing Christian, as his goal is merely to get the person out of his struggle, merely to help the person's burden get eased in some way. And that can still be very anthropocentric counseling, man-centered counseling. But I want to say this, as we think of God's perfections, I want to make this chief assertion that what we already acknowledged as the chief end of man, that first question and answer in the Westminster Shorter Confession, which so beautifully and memorably summarized the teaching of Scripture, the chief end of man. The chief end of man must be the beginning of all theocentric counseling, or you could say the foundation of all theocentric counseling. Now, what was the chief end of man? Remember what the Westminster Shorter Confession asked and answered. The question was, what is the chief end of man? Man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. That's man's chief end. And so, as you think of helping others in the ministry that God has given to you and in the influence that you can have in the lives of other people, whether that's informally or formally in some kind of formal counseling context or formal discipleship context, you must always remember, we must always remember that the chief end of man is the foundation of all theocentric counseling. What are you seeking to do? First in your own life, then to model it to others, and then to exhort it in others. It's this. It's to glorify God and to enjoy him, to have him as the object of enjoyment. And that is to mark all of what we do in counseling. This is why we minister to one another. This is what we strive for, to see our fellow brother or sister in Christ glorify God and enjoy him. That's the chief end. Now, as I said, that's often not within the view of counseling. And Robert Jones, in one of his chapters in the book Counseling Hard Cases, he says this: most counseling problems reflect a distorted view of God and a deficient relationship with Christ. That's really where it all comes from. Where do we get off track? Or why have we become the problem that we are? And why have we got ourselves into our struggle with this particular issue or that particular issue with anger, jealousy, envy, greed, lust, you name it? Why do we find ourselves there? Well, it comes from a distorted view of God and a defective relationship with Christ. Now, there's got to be a lot of practical steps to help someone to mortify those sins and to put on Christ, but it must be recognized that we've got into that predicament, or we are in that predicament, because of a distorted view of God. We have begun to listen to the deceitfulness of sin and have stopped looking upon the beauties and glory of God. Coming back to A.W. Tozer, he made some wonderful statements along this line in that work, Knowledge of the Holy. And there's certain things that Tozer states that we would disagree with, but he had a knack for recognizing some of the problems in the church of his day in a very succinct, concise manner. He said this: the church has surrendered her once lofty concept of God and has substituted it for one so low, so ignoble, as to be utterly unworthy of thinking, worshiping men. This she has done not deliberately, but little by little and without her knowledge. And her very unawareness only makes the situation all the more tragic. The low view of God entertained almost universally among Christians is the cause of 100 lesser evils everywhere among us. Again, pointed to the fact that a lot of our problems are all of our problems can be traced directly back to a deficient view of God. He continues, he says, a right conception of God is basic not only to systematic theology, but to practical Christian living as well. It is to worship what the foundation is to the temple. Where it is inadequate or out of plumb, the whole structure must sooner or later collapse. I believe there is scarcely an error in doctrine or a failure in applying Christian ethics that cannot be traced finally to imperfect and ignoble thoughts about God. You can liken it to a tree that, you know, we're so often If you're an arborist, you like trees and growing trees and like cultivating fruit, you can focus all your attention just on the leaves and the fruit. But those things really, if we compare them to ourselves, just as we would to a tree, those things are really the result of something else. They're the visible manifestations of the health of the tree. And so we could say the leaves and the fruit of a tree are like our own speech and actions, the things that are tangible in our lives. We would look at the trunk and the branches, the limbs, as the supporting features of that which is immediately visible. When you see a tree, you typically see the fruit and the leaves first. The limbs and the branches are usually hidden behind all of that, but they're the supporting features, our attitudes and our motives. But really, what determines all of that is the state of the roots. And if you liken that to our lives, our roots are our thoughts. Our roots are our most basic ideas. The roots are our presuppositions about us, about the life around us, and all of that is fundamentally about God. And the state of the roots determine the quantity and quality of the fruit. And so, looking at it again from another illustration here, if you look on this slide and you look on the left-hand side, there you see a very healthy tree. It's got deep green leaves. It looks vibrant, healthy, resistant to diseases. And you would see that is all a result of a very healthy root system, which is, in the Christian life, is made up of healthy thinking about God, or thinking about Him that is biblical, is not based on intuition, it's not based on feelings and anecdotes and experiences, but is based on His revelation of Himself. It's intentional. We recognize that the manner of sanctification, the way of seeing the good leaves, is to have an intentionality to our study, to our thinking, to what we put into our minds. And it's also habitual. It doesn't just happen once a week, but it's a practice of life. It's a walk that we have. And to the degree that there is healthy thinking about God, there will be then the vibrancy of all of the fruit and the leaves. On the other hand, if you see on the right-hand part of that screen, when there's unhealthy thinking about God, that is unbiblical, in other words, it's not based on Scripture, that it is accidental, in other words, it kind of comes by the way, and it's not any kind of planned, intentional practice, or it's inconsistent, it happens every so often, that leads to unhealthy thinking about God, and it leads to a tree that is obviously suffering, that is not resistant to diseases, that cannot stand in the storm, and that does not manifest beauty. And so God's perfections, and in meditating on these perfections, are essential to health because they're the roots of our existence. We're talking about something that affects our most basic ideas and understandings and presuppositions about life. Now, consider for just a moment, coming with that in mind, come back to what I said at the beginning of God's perfections, and that they're not parts of God, and there's not greater and lesser ones, but that God's perfections are His essence. He is omnipotent. He is holiness. He is love, etc. You might say, in that beginning, you might have thought, how does that relate to practical counseling? Well, I want to give you several ways in which there's a lot of practicality, even with what we spoke of at the beginning of this session. And I look here to the textbook Biblical Doctrine by John MacArthur and Richard Mayhew, and they pull out several really good, helpful illustrations here. First of all, the assertion that God is fully each of His perfections. God is love, fully, perfectly. God is sovereign, fully, perfectly. God is righteous, fully, perfectly. It's not just a part of him. It is who he is. And we assert this, and that God's perfections, as Mayhew and MacArthur state, God's perfections characterize him totally, eternally, and infinitely. Now, how does this affect counseling? Let me just give you a quick application here. In our effort to help struggling Christians, we must emphasize to them that God never ceases to be God in all of his perfections. Because here's one of the things that manifests itself, especially, we know this from our own experience, when we get into a trial and life becomes painful, it's a common knee-jerk reaction, because we think of God through the prism of our own experience, that God has ceased to be loving in that moment. Or that God has ceased to be wise in that moment. Because what is our question? God, why have you done this? Why have you brought this trial into my life? Don't you love me? Don't you know what's best for me? And that expresses a root deficiency in theology at that moment. What needs to be corrected by you as a counselor, and of course corrected in a most gracious, loving way, is to come alongside that person and to say, you know what? Let's study the character of God. Let's for a moment, or for a while, not focus on the circumstance. Trust me. Let's look at who God is. And even studying this seemingly academic, abstract thought that God is not made up of parts, but that he is love, he is all-knowing and all-wise, that all of a sudden it helps us realize, no, God has never ceased to be perfect in his love. He can never cease to be wise. What makes God God is that he doesn't turn off certain perfections or limit certain perfections. He always is these things perfectly. Secondly, God's perfections qualify each other. They're interrelated, and Mayhew and MacArthur say this: each of his perfections complements and qualifies each of his other perfections. In other words, these things are not at war within himself. In our effort to help struggling Christians, we must affirm that God's love is always a perfectly righteous love. His sovereignty is always a perfectly all-wise sovereignty. So again, sometimes in our effort to describe God, we compartmentalize and we think of these or conceive of these properties as just being distinct. That's the problem of categorization. These things exist somehow in different categories, and that's never the case. And one of our responsibilities and the best news for people to hear who are in the midst of trial is to say that God's love is always an all-wise love. His sovereignty is always an all-loving sovereignty. His wisdom is always an all-knowing wisdom. His faithfulness is always an all-powerful faithfulness. And that there's not somehow this distinction, this polar opposite thing that exists within God as he might move from one perfection to the other. No, all of his perfections are described by each other. And it's helpful for our people to understand that, to remember that, to have that recalled to their attention. And in particular, his sovereignty is always loving and his love is always sovereign. Number three, God's perfections are active. Each of God's perfections, MacArthur Mayhew state, each of his perfections is fully active in his essence. God is never passive or inactive. And again, in our effort to help struggling Christians, we must remind them that none of God's perfections are ever suspended. They're always active. It's never that we have to call upon God to be loving or call upon God to be merciful because he's somehow put the pause button on that or suspended it in time. And as we minister to people and help them lift their eyes off the pain of their struggle to the very source of their joy. It's to say, God has not forsaken you. He still is the God of love. He has always been. He hasn't pressed the pause button. He's always the God of compassion. He isn't at the time right now in your life where his hands are tied and he's powerless. Because these things are perfections, they exist eternally and are never suspended. God is always these things. Number four, God's perfections should be studied with one another. A fourth conclusion that MacArthur and Mayhew draw from these general surveys of God's perfections. Since God is totally each of his perfections, one should not study a single perfection of God in isolation from all his other perfections. Now, here's an interesting observation to make, because due to the unhealthy preaching in a lot of churches, all that some Christians have ever heard are just some of God's properties. They've just heard over and over again how God is loving, but they haven't heard of God's righteousness and his holiness. And you especially go back to the ministry of R.C. Sproul, right? And I remember this growing up in a context which was a little bit that way, of always just emphasizing God's love and not his holiness. I was blown away when I read the book by R.C. Sproul, I think published back in the 80s, The Holiness of God. And I saw in that moment that some of the problems I was dealing with as a young man were tied to the fact that I just had never really heard of God's holiness. I had read the Bible somewhat superficially, but I'd always been told God is love, God is love, God is love, and he is. But I had not seen that perfection preached alongside his holiness. And so some of the very problems we face in life come from the fact that we're ignorant of some of God's perfections. And so as we seek to deal with people and their problems, one of our responsibilities is to say, I know right now that you're desperate to focus on God's love, and we'll do that, but we also will look at what God has said about himself in totality. That we're not helped by just a focus just on one thing that we think will be the solution. We must realize God is God in all of these things. In our effort to help struggling Christians, we must never downplay certain perfections as irrelevant or unhelpful to the resolution of their problems. Yes, they may be asking major why questions, but that cannot be just answered by a focus on a part. Five, God's perfections are reflexive. This is important. Each of the perfections is active toward God as their perfect object. And so in our effort to help struggling Christians, we must remind them that joy comes in delighting in his perfection. And what MacArthur and Mayhew mean by this is that God has manifest these things to the praise of his glory. And it's only when we look upon that reality from the standpoint of the sinfulness of our own human hearts and our own desire for the status of godness within our own context, we look on that phrase that God does things to the praise of his glory, we look at that as selfish. We look at that as somehow prideful in the sinful sense, because again, we look at that through our own experience. We want to do things for the praise of our glory. We certainly feel that, and we acknowledge that's sinful. But it's sinful when we do it because of our creaturely status. But because God is perfect, all things must be done for the praise of his glory because of that perfection. And to do anything other than that is not going to result in joy and peace and satisfaction on the part of creation. One of the biggest challenges we face in counseling is to help others to change their agenda in life from just a movement from some kind of pain to relief, but to realize that in this life, our greatest joy will come from making much of God. And so, because God's perfections all point the glory back to Himself, our agenda must be in ministering to others. Our agenda must be that the greatest solution to their problem is not just an escape, but to get their agenda in line with God and to make much of God. Again, that comes back to that statement we made. The foundation of all theocentric counseling must be the chief end of man, to glorify God and to enjoy Him. Now, I know we have time for questions here. I had a little bit left, but I'm going to postpone that. I was going to look at Asaph in Psalm 73, but I want to give time for questions now. And then perhaps in the next session, we'll come back to Psalm 73 if we have time in that.
Thank you, Brad, very much. Since I have the mic, I'm actually going to ask you a question.
Sure.
And take advantage of this moment. You and I talked a moment ago. I think one of the statements that you've made that I think would just help all of us to just elaborate on just a little bit is, you know, when you said that our need as we face problems in our life is not so much to focus on the problem, but it is to focus on God. And I, you know, understand that statement, I believe, as you make it, you know, that it's at the part of the solution is not just the problem,
yeah.
Right? We need to add to the equation, yeah. Right, who God is in particular as we think about the totality, right, of what the solution, right, to the equation ultimately is. I think, like you reflected on with Job, I think that was a big part of it. That is a foundational book in that regard, as Job faced incredible difficulties. I mean, I think far beyond what many of us may have faced.
Yeah.
And even as one of the first books, you know, written to really help us approach God and life and problems, et cetera. And so can you elaborate just a little bit on, you know, what your thoughts are, really the kind of the bigger picture of the context of the conference is on God and our problems and difficulties, and kind of what you meant by, you know, our problem isn't the problem, right? But sometimes our deficient knowledge, understanding of God in particular.
Yeah, that's a big question, and certainly we don't want to trivialize problems, nor do we want to kind of take an approach in which we just say to people, yeah, we don't need to talk about your problem at all or your trouble, your trial. We're just going to read books on the doctrine of God, and that's all we're going to do. And we do need to realize that there is a practical process in place. We've got to walk through steps. There's got to be deliberate effort to take Scripture, the truth of God, and apply it to real attitudes and circumstances in life, regardless of what that problem is, greed, jealousy, anger, lust, and so on. And Scripture does provide us with paradigms for dealing with those different kinds of sins. But that will only be successful if we get the foundation right. And again, if in helping people in the middle of their struggle, if we don't help them lift their eyes to the source and to realize that God is the greatest need, not just a solution, but God Himself is the greatest need, then either a person in the midst of trouble will never believe that there is a solution because of his deficient view of God, low view of God, and there's helplessness and hopelessness in that. And by failing to first and fundamentally get the focus on God, you exacerbate the hopelessness. Because when we do look at it, apart from God, there just isn't help. So we have to start by getting the thoughts there, and that establishes hope. But also, in dealing with people and in ourselves in the midst of trials, we can very easily treat the solution as the greatest thing. And so if a, for example, with this couple that I met with right before coming here, the solution just isn't we're going to put your marriage back together so that you'll be able to live together and have joy together and experience some form of marital unity and peace and joy. For some people, that is all that they want, and so that becomes the idol. And you know what? In this life, that's never going to be fully 100% achievable. And people will only become disillusioned when they realize their marriage might come back together, but it really doesn't fill the hole in the heart. And so we have to help people realize in the midst of their struggles that the solution isn't the escape from the problem or putting the pieces back together is good. We want to help you, and we're going to share the burden toward that end, but ultimately what you need is God. And I can't promise that the marriage will ever be put back together. This couple, I don't know. There's so many years of problems, and on one of the spouses' part, just an utter disinterest in putting it back together. We can never promise that. And when we help people in their midst of their troubles, we can never promise that we'll make it all go away. And so a solution in that sense may never be achievable in this life. So how do we instill hope, and how do we find satisfaction in the midst of those trials? And that is to get people focused on God, and to remember that even in the midst, even though the fig tree should wither, I will trust in the Lord. In fact, that's the message of Psalm 73, but let me read from Habakkuk that text. This is really what we're after in the midst of all of our trials and tribulations and struggles. Habakkuk says in Habakkuk 3:17-19, though the fig tree should not blossom, and there be no fruit on the vine, though the yield of the olive tree should fail and the fields produce no fruit, though the flock should be cut off from the fold and there be no cattle in the stalls. What he's describing there is a life of barrenness. And of course, in the agrarian culture of ancient Israel, this is the picture of living the cursed life. There's just, what is there? Dry fields, empty fields, no trees, everything's dead. And yet Habakkuk says, yet I will exult in the Lord. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. The Lord is my strength, and he has made my feet like hinds' feet and makes me walk on my high places. What we want to help people to do and what we need in our own lives is the ability to exult in the Lord when the fig tree does not blossom. And it may be, like in Job's life, later on, God restores and blesses even more. But that's not a promise in this life. God may never return a departed spouse. He may never return good health. He may never return a child who walks away, a prodigal. And yet, we want people to be able to seize this and imitate Habakkuk's words here, that even in the midst of that, one can still exult in the Lord and rejoice in the God of his or her salvation. And that'll only come by having the foundation of all of our counseling focused on the character of God and who he really is.
Yeah, and I'd just say we could probably talk for the rest of the day, nearly, on this topic. But just to say a couple of things is, you know, when he says something just very briefly about, you know, in the God of my salvation, when those things happen, to know just very briefly that God is in control and that he's a good God.
Yeah.
You know, those are things you can say, Lord, I don't understand why you have let it happen, but I also trust that these things are true about you, and that your plans and perfect plan and purposes are being worked out in and amongst my life and in the church's life, my community's life, etc., as these things go on. Yeah. And so I think, you know, that absolutely, just like you mentioned about marriage, you know, as well too, we can't promise things will turn around necessarily. But if that couple does follow, right, God's plan for marriage, if they learn his character, his graciousness and his compassion, his love, his mercy, his forgiveness, etc., they have a blueprint, essentially, in his character, through his word, to restore what God truly desires, and that unity and the love that was present, at least we hope, in that marriage at some point. While also, too, I think, like you were saying, that's not a promise. One spouse could do that. The other does not. This marriage ultimately never comes back. And so God's glory has to be the chief motivator and the chief good, ultimately, that. And I think, just to wrap it up, is one of my favorite passages that speak of this, too, speaking about just God and our problems, is Galatians 5, and it talks about walking in the Spirit. As we follow the Word of God, we walk in the Spirit-provided words with His strength and help, obviously. The fruit of the Spirit's produced: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, and that's in the midst of problems, potentially. You can see that in Habakkuk's life here, and even in the spouse's life, in that marriage that falls apart, unfortunately, when the idol is not, I have to have a right marriage, a respectful husband, wife, etc., but God be glorified, that then the problems that normally compel us to receive counsel, depression, discouragement, anger, are resolved largely in, in who God is and the word that he's, the wisdom that he's provided, you know, to us as well, too. So hopefully that, guys, that helps you as you connect a lot of those things. I've thought of like three other examples, too, that we could probably talk about as well, but time escapes us a little bit. Any other questions before we break for lunch?
Hey, I thought the whole talk on the love and the trees and everything was great. What are your thoughts of a church today, churches today in general, with, it just feels like the love aspect in these churches today, with them just focusing on the love and not the holiness, is just getting worse and worse. What are your thoughts on that? How we got there? Or,
Well, specifically with that, that problem in the church, sinners who want to be religious will try to, you know, maintain a semblance of God in a way that's going to still affirm their aspirations and desires, and so emphasizing the love of God and that unconditional aspect of God's love is just a very convenient truth for them. And so that's why that particular property or perfection of God is clung to with such tenacity, is that they want that unconditional love of God. Now, we can make a mistake in response to that and somehow either change the definition of God's love. We must continue to preach its unconditional nature, or we just ignore that perfection of God and just focus on his justice or wrath or righteousness. The best thing for us to do, rather than just react or have this knee-jerk reaction, is just to continue to teach and preach the whole counsel of God. And again, these perfections are related to each other and intertwined and inseparable from each other, and all kinds of heresies arise when certain perfections are ignored or they're treated in distinction. We need to just keep on affirming the whole counsel. Now, there is a place for compensating for neglect, and so books like R.C. Sproul's book, The Holiness of God, which is a fantastic book, and I'm so thankful I got it as a young man, and it was revolutionary in my life. I still remember the pages, the cover, all that kind of stuff, because it had such an impact, because it filled in a deficit. So we can do some of that, and we must do some of that preaching on the holiness of God. But let's not go to the other extreme and forget preaching on God's love. And that has been, unfortunately, one of the tendencies. And incorrect understandings of God's love grow when there's been a lack of preaching on it. So let's preach on the love of God, and not just his holiness, but together, so that Christians are well nurtured and natured within that understanding and therefore not given in to imbalances. I hope that answers your question a little. So, okay?
Maybe one more question before we break for lunch.
If not, maybe I'll make a statement here just quickly, as maybe someone is thinking of a question, but some to pick up on what you had said. I had dinner last night with somebody from the area here, and he said something to me which I thought is so applicable to what you just said. Is he was explaining that his wife was undergoing chemo treatment, and so I asked him about how he was doing in the midst of that and how the whole trial was impacting the family and so on, and his response was just so precious, and it's based on a God-centered, God-infatuated view of life. He said to me, you know, Brad, even if the Lord would take her, I would still confess that God is kind. And that, you can't say that unless you have prepared yourself for life's trial by studying what God has said about himself, and you have believed, you've trusted in his word. And you know that that's what we want to cultivate in all of us, as well as in the people that we minister to and disciple, is that we want to prepare them for trials so that even if the Lord takes away that which is most precious in life, that they would still confess God is love. God is kind and compassionate.
Yeah, I think some of the reasons why that happens, at least through my experience in counseling, is people often think kind of backwards in the way that they define who God is. They look through the lens of their circumstances.
Yeah.
Instead of first learning the lens of Scripture and allowing that to define their view of God, and then thinking through their circumstances,
yeah,
in particular. And I think that, I think, is a great illustration,
yep,
of a person who's grounded in the Word and a right view of God, and really a right view of life, you know, mm-hmm, as well, too, that doesn't have it backwards in, yeah, so many ways. So.